When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 19 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 19. How a Squire of England met a Squire of France. Sir Robert Knolles, with his little fleet, had sighted the Breton coast near Cancale. They had rounded the Point de Gouin, and finally had sailed past the port of Saint-Malo and down the long, narrow estuary of the Rance, until they were close to the old walled city of Dinan, which was held by that Montfort faction whose cause the English had espoused. Here the horses had been disembarked, the stores were unloaded, and the whole force encamped outside the city, whilst the leaders waited for news as to the present state of affairs, and where there was most hope of honour and profit. The whole of France was feeling the effects of that war with England, which had already lasted some 10 years. But no province was in so dreadful a condition as this unhappy land of Brittany. In Normandy or Picardy, the inroads of the English were periodical, with intervals of rest between. But Brittany was torn asunder by constant civil war apart from the grapple of the two great combatants, so that there was no surcease of her sufferings. The struggle had begun in 1341, through the rival claims of Montfort and of Blois to the vacant dukedom. England had taken the part of Montfort, France that of Blois. Neither faction was strong enough to destroy the other, and so, after 10 years of continual fighting, history recorded a long, ineffectual list of surprises and ambushes, of raids and skirmishes, of towns taken and retaken, of alternate victory and defeat, in which neither party could claim a supremacy. It mattered nothing that Montfort and Blois had both disappeared from the scene, the one dead and the other taken by the English. Their wives caught up the swords which had dropped from the hands of their lords, and the long struggle went on even more savagely than before. In the south and east, the Blois faction held the country, and Nantes, the capital, was garrisoned and occupied by a strong French army. In the north and the west, the Montfort party prevailed, for the island kingdom was at their back, and always fresh sails broke the northern skyline, bearing adventurers from over the channel. Between these two, there lay a broad zone comprising all the centre of the country, which was a land of blood and violence, where no law prevailed save that of the sword. From end to end it was dotted with castles, some held for one side, some for the other, and many mere robber strongholds, the scenes of gross and monstrous deeds, whose brute owners, knowing that they could never be called to account, made war upon all mankind, and wrung with rack and with flame the last shilling from all who fell into their savage hands. The fields had long been untilled. Commerce was dead. From Rennes in the east to Hennebon in the west, and from Dinan in the north to Nantes in the south, there was no spot where a man's life or a woman's honour was safe. Such was the land, full of darkness and blood, the saddest, blackest spot in Christendom, into which Knolles and his men were now advancing. But there was no sadness in the young heart of Nigel, as he rode by the side of Knolles at the head of a clump of spears, nor did it seem to him that fate had led him into an unduly arduous path. On the contrary, he blessed the good fortune which had sent him into so delightful a country, and it seemed to him as he listened to dreadful stories of robber barons and looked round at the black scars of war which lay branded upon the fair faces of the hills, that no hero of romances or trouveur had ever journeyed through such a land of promise, with so fair a chance of knightly venture and honourable advancement. The Red Ferret was one deed towards his vow. Surely a second, and perhaps a better, was to be found somewhere upon this glorious countryside. He had borne himself as the others had in the sea fight, and could not count it to his credit where he had done no more than mere duty. Something beyond this was needed for such a deed as could be laid at the feet of the Lady Mary. But surely it was to be found here, in fermenting war-distracted Brittany. Then, with two done, it would be strange if he could not find occasion for that third one, which would complete his service and set him free to look her in the face once more. With the great yellow horse curvetting beneath him, his Guildford armour gleaming in the sun, his sword clanking against his stirrup iron, and his father's tough ash spear in his hand, he rode with a light heart and a smiling face, looking eagerly to right and to left for any chance which his good fate might send. The road from Dinan to Colne, along which the small army was moving, rose and dipped over undulating ground, with a bare marshy plain upon the left, where the river Rance ran down to the sea, while upon the right lay a wooded country with a few wretched villages, so poor and sordid that they had nothing with which to tempt the spoiler. The peasants had left them at the first twinkle of a steel cap, and lurked at the edges of the woods, ready in an instant to dive into those secret recesses known only to themselves. These creatures suffered sorely at the hands of both parties, but when the chance came, they revenged their wrongs on either in a savage way which brought fresh brutalities upon their heads. The newcomers soon had a chance of seeing to what lengths they would go, for in the roadway near to Colne they came upon an English man-at-arms who had been waylaid and slain by them. How they had overcome him could not be told, but how they had slain him within his armour was horribly apparent, for they had carried such a rock as eight men could lift, and had dropped it upon him as he lay, so that he was spread out in his shattered case like a crab beneath a stone. Many a fist was shaken at the distant woods, and many a curse hurled at those who haunted them, as the column of scowling soldiers passed the murdered man, whose badge of the Moline Cross showed him to have been a follower of that house of Bentley, whose head, Sir Walter, was at that time leader of the British forces in the country. Sir Robert Knolles had served in Brittany before, and he marshalled his men on the march with the skill and caution of the veteran soldier, the man who leaves as little as possible to chance, having too steadfast a mind to heed the fool who may think him over-cautious. He had recruited a number of bowmen and men-at-arms at Dinan, so that his following was now close upon 500 men. In front, under his own leadership, were 50 mounted lancers, fully armed and ready for any sudden attack. Behind them, on foot, came the archers, and a second body of mounted men closed up the rear. Out upon either flank moved small bodies of cavalry, and a dozen scouts, spread fanwise, probed every gorge and dingle in front of the column. So for 3 days he moved slowly down the southern road. Sir Thomas Percy and Sir James Astley had ridden to the head of the column, and Knolles conferred with them as they marched concerning the plan of their campaign. Percy and Astley were young and hot-headed, with wild visions of dashing deeds and knight-errantry, but Knolles, with cold, clear brain and purpose of iron, held ever his object in view. "By the holy Dunstan and all the saints of Lindisfarne," cried the fiery borderer, "it goes to my heart to ride forward when there are such honourable chances on either side of us. Have I not heard that the French are at Evron, beyond the river? And is it not sooth that yonder castle, the towers of which I see above the woods, is in the hands of a traitor who is false to his liege lord of Montfort? There is little profit to be gained upon this road, for the folk seem to have no heart for war. Had we ventured as far over the marches of Scotland as we are now in Brittany, we should not have lacked some honourable venture or chance of winning worship." "You say truth, Thomas," cried Astley, a red-faced and choleric young man. "It is well certain that the French will not come to us, and surely it is the more needful that we go to them. In sooth, any soldier who sees us would smile that we should creep for 3 days along this road as though a thousand dangers lay before us, when we have but poor broken peasants to deal with." But Robert Knolles shook his head.
"We know not what are in these woods or behind these hills," said he. "And when I know nothing, it is my wont to prepare for the worst which may befall. It is but prudence to do so."
"Your enemies might find some harsher name for it," said Astley with a sneer. "Nay, you need not think to scare me by glaring at me, Sir Robert, nor will your ill pleasure change my thoughts. I have faced fiercer eyes than thine, and I have not feared."
"Your speech, Sir James, is neither courteous nor good," said Knolles. "And if I were a free man, I would cram your words down your throat with the point of my dagger. But I am here to lead these men in profit and honor, not to quarrel with every fool who has not the wit to understand how soldiers should be led. Can you not see that if I make attempts here and there, as you would have me do, I shall have weakened my strength before I come to that part where it can best be spent?"
And where is that?" asked Percy.
"'Fore God, Astley, it is in my mind that we ride with one who knows more of war than you or I, and that we would be wise to be guided by his rede. Tell us, then, what is in your mind."
30 miles from here," said Knolles, "there is, as I am told, a fortalice named Ploermel, and within it is one Bambro', an Englishman, with a good garrison. No great distance from him is the castle of Josselin, where dwells Robert of Beaumanoir, with a great following of Breton. It is my intention that we should join Bambro', and so be in such strength that we may throw ourselves upon Josselin, and by taking it become the masters of all mid-Brittany, and able to make head against the Frenchmen in the south."
"Indeed, I think that you can do no better," said Percy heartily. "And I swear to you on jeopardy of my soul that I will stand by you in the matter. I doubt not that when we come deep into their lair, they will draw together and do what they may to make head against us.
But up to now, I swear by all the saints of Lindisfarne that I should have seen more war in a summer's day in Liddesdale or at the forest of Jedburgh than any that Brittany has shown us. But see, yonder horsemen are riding in. They are our own hobblers, are they not? Who are these who are lashed to their stirrups?"
A small troop of mounted bowmen had ridden out of an oak grove upon the left of the road. They trotted up to where the three knights had halted. Two wretched peasants, whose wrists had been tied to their leathers, came leaping and straining beside the horses in an effort not to be dragged off their feet. One was a tall, gaunt, yellow-haired man, the other short and swarthy, but both so crusted with dirt, so matted and tangled and ragged, that they were more like beasts of the wood than human beings.
"What is this?" asked Knolles. "Have I not ordered you to leave the country folk at peace?"
The leader of the archers, old Wat of Carlisle, held up a sword, a girdle, and a dagger.
"If it please you, fair sir," said he, "I saw the glint of these, and I thought them no fit tools for hands which were made for the spade and the plough.
But when we had ridden them down and taken them, there was the Bentley cross upon each, and we knew that they had belonged to yonder dead Englishman upon the road. Surely, then, these are two of the villains who have slain them, and it is right that we do justice upon them."
Sure enough, upon sword, girdle, and dagger shone the silver Molene cross, which had gleamed upon the dead man's armour. Knolles looked at them, and then at the prisoners, with a face of stone. At the sight of those fell eyes, they had dropped with inarticulate howls upon their knees, screaming out their protests in a tongue which none could understand.
"We must have the road safe for wandering Englishmen," said Knolles. "These men must surely die. Hang them to yonder tree."
He pointed to a live oak by the roadside, and rode onward upon his way in converse with his fellow knights. But the old bowman had ridden after him.
"If it please you, Sir Robert, the bowmen would fain put these men to death in their own fashion," said he.
"So that they die, I care not how," Knolles answered carelessly, and looked back no more.
Human life was cheap in those stern days, when the footman of a stricken army or the crew of a captured ship was slain without any question or thought of mercy by the victors. War was a rude game, with death for the stake, and the forfeit was always claimed on the one side and paid on the other, without doubt or hesitation. Only the knight might be spared, since his ransom made him worth more alive than dead. To men trained in such a school, with death forever hanging over their own heads, it may be well believed that the slaying of the two peasant murderers was a small matter. And yet there was a special reason why upon this occasion the bowmen wished to keep the deed in their own hands. Ever since their dispute aboard the Basilisk, there had been ill-feeling betwixt Bartholomew, the old bald-headed bowyer,
and Long Ned Widdington, the Dalesman, which had ended in a conflict at Dinan, in which not only they but a dozen of their friends had been laid upon the cobblestones. The dispute raged round their respective knowledge and skill with the bow, and now some quick wit amongst the soldiers had suggested a grim fashion in which it should be put to the proof, once for all, which could draw the surer shaft. A thick wood lay 200 paces from the road upon which the archers stood. A stretch of smooth, grassy sward lay between. The two peasants were led out 50 yards from the road, with their faces toward the wood. There they stood, held on a leash, and casting many a wondering, frightened glance over their shoulders at the preparations which were being made behind them. Old Bartholomew and the big Yorkshireman had stepped out of the ranks and stood side by side, each with his strung bow in his left hand and a single arrow in his right. With care they had drawn on and greased their shooting gloves and fastened their braces. They plucked and cast up a few blades of grass to measure the wind, examined every small point of their tackle, turned their sides to the mark, and widened their feet in a firm stance. From all sides came chaff and counsel from their comrades.
"A three-quarter wind, bowyer," cried one. "Aim a body's breadth to the right."
"But not thy body's breadth, bowyer," laughed another, "else may you be over-wide."
"Nay, this wind will scarce turn a well-drawn shaft," said a third. "Shoot dead upon him, and you'll be clapping a clout."
"Steady, Ned, for the good name of the Dales," cried a Yorkshireman. "Loose easy and pluck not, or I am 5 crowns the poorer man."
"A week's pay on Bartholomew," shouted another. "Now, old fat-pate, fail me not."
"Enough, enough, stint your talk," cried the old bowman Wat of Carlisle.
"Were your shafts as quick as your tongues, there would be no facing you. Do you shoot upon the little one, Bartholomew, and you, Ned, upon the other. Give them law until I cry the word, and then loose in your own fashion and at your own time. Are you ready? Hola, there, Hayward, Beddington, let them run."
The leashes were torn away, and the two men, stooping their heads, ran madly for the shelter of the wood, amid such a howl from the archers as beaters may give when the hare starts from its form. The two bowmen, each with his arrow drawn to the pile, stood like russet statues, menacing, motionless, their eager eyes fixed upon the fugitives, their bow-staves rising slowly as the distance between them lengthened. The Bretons were halfway to the wood, and still old Wat was silent. It may have been mercy, or it may have been mischief, but at least the chase should have a fair chance of life. At 60 paces he turned his grizzled head at last.
"Loose!"
he cried. At the word, the Yorkshireman's bowstring twanged. It was not for nothing that he had earned the name of being one of the deadliest archers of the north, and had twice borne away the silver arrow of Selby. Swift and true flew the fatal shaft, and buried itself to the feather in the curved back of the long yellow-haired peasant. Without a sound he fell upon his face and lay stone dead upon the grass, the one short white plume between his dark shoulders to mark where death had smote him. The Yorkshireman threw his bow-stave into the air and danced in triumph, whilst his comrades roared their fierce delight in a shout of applause, which changed suddenly into a tempest of hooting and of laughter. The smaller peasant, more cunning than his comrade, had run more slowly, but with many a backward glance. He had marked his companion's fate, and had waited with keen eyes until he saw the bowyer loose his string. At the moment he had thrown himself flat upon the grass, and had heard the arrow scream above him, and seen it quiver in the turf beyond. Instantly he had sprung to his feet again, and amid wild whoops and halloos from the bowmen, had made for the shelter of the wood. Now he had reached it, and 60 good paces separated him from the nearest of his persecutors. Surely they could not reach him here. With the tangled brushwood behind him, he was as safe as a rabbit at the mouth of his burrow. In the joy of his heart, he must needs dance in derision and snap his fingers at the foolish men who had let him slip. He threw back his head, howling at them like a dog, and at the instant an arrow struck him full in the throat and laid him dead among the bracken. There was a hush of surprised silence, and then a loud cheer burst from the archers.
"By the root of Beverley," cried old Wat, "I have not seen a finer roving shaft this many a year. In my own best day I could not have bettered it. Which of you loosed it?"
"It was Aylward of Tilford, Samkin Aylward," cried a score of voices,
and the bowman, flushed at his own fame, was pushed to the front.
"Indeed, I would that it had been at a nobler mark," said he. "He might have gone free for me, but I could not keep my fingers from the string when he turned to jeer at us."
"I see well that you are indeed a master bowman," said old Wat, "and it is comfort to my soul to think that if I fall, I leave such a man behind me to hold high the credit of our craft. Now, gather your shafts and on, for Sir Robert awaits us on the brow of the hill."
All day Knolles and his men marched through the same wild and deserted country, inhabited only by these furtive creatures, hares to the strong and wolves to the weak, who hovered in the shadows of the wood. Ever and anon upon the tops of the hills they caught a glimpse of horsemen who watched them from a distance and vanished when approached. Sometimes bells rang an alarm from villages among the hills, and twice they passed castles which drew up their drawbridges at their approach and lined their walls with hooting soldiers as they passed. The Englishmen gathered a few oxen and sheep from the pastures of each, but Knolles had no mind to break his strength upon stone walls, and so he went upon his way. Once at St. Mean they passed a great nunnery, girt with a high, grey, lichened wall, an oasis of peace in this desert of war, the black-robed nuns basking in the sun or working in the gardens, with the strong, gentle hand of Holy Church shielding them ever from evil. The archers doffed caps to them as they passed, for the boldest and roughest dared not cross that line guarded by the dire ban and blight, which was the one only force in the whole steel-ridden earth which could stand betwixt the weakling and the spoiler. The little army halted at St. Mean, and cooked its midday meal. It had gathered into its ranks again, and was about to start, when Knolles drew Nigel to one side. "Nigel," said he, "it seems to me that I have seldom set eyes upon a horse which hath more power and promise of speed than this great beast of thine."
"It is indeed a noble steed, fair sir," said Nigel.
Betwixt him and his young leader there had sprung up great affection and respect since the day that they set foot in the basilisk.
"It will be the better if you stretch his limbs, for he grows over heavy," said the knight. "Now mark me, Nigel. Yonder, betwixt the ash tree and the red rock, what do you see on the side of the far hill?"
"There is a white dot upon it. Surely it is a horse."
"I have marked it all morning, Nigel. This horseman has kept ever upon our flank, spying upon us or waiting to make some attempt upon us. Now, I should be right glad to have a prisoner, for it is my wish to know something of this countryside, and these peasants can speak neither French nor English. I would have you linger here in hiding when we go forward. This man will still follow us. When he does so, yonder wood will lie betwixt you and him. Do you ride round it and come upon him from behind? There is broad plain upon his left, and we will cut him off upon the right. If your horse be indeed the swifter, then you cannot fail to take him." Nigel had already sprung down and was tightening Pommer's girth. "Nay, there is no need of haste, for you cannot start until we are 2 miles upon our way. And above all, I pray you, Nigel, none of your knight-errant ways. It is this Rowan that I want, him and the news he can bring me. Think little of your own advancement and much of the needs of the army. When you get him, ride westwards upon the sun, and you cannot fail to find the road." Nigel waited with Pommers under the shadow of the nunnery wall, horse and man chafing with impatience, whilst above them 6 round-eyed, innocent nun faces looked down on this strange and disturbing vision from the outer world. At last the long column wound itself out of sight round a curve of the road, and the white dot was gone from the bare green flank of the hill. Nigel bowed his steel head to the nuns, gave his bridle a shake, and bounded off upon his welcome mission. The round-eyed sisters saw a yellow horse and twinkling man sweep round the skirt of the wood, caught a last glimmer of him through the tree trunks, and paced slowly back to their pruning and their planting, their minds filled with the beauty and the terror of that outer world beyond the high grey lichen-mottled wall. Everything fell out even as Knolles had planned. As Nigel rounded the oak forest, there, upon the farther side of it, with only good greensward between, was the rider upon the white horse. Already he was so near that Nigel could see him clearly, a young cavalier, proud in his bearing, clad in purple silk tunic with a red curling feather in his low black cap. He wore no armour, but his sword gleamed at his side. He rode easily and carelessly, as one who cares for no man,
and his eyes were forever fixed upon the English soldiers on the road. So intent was he upon them that he gave no thought to his own safety, and it was only when the low thunder of the great horse's hoofs broke upon his ears that he turned in his saddle, looked very coolly and steadily at Nigel, then gave his own bridle a shake, and darted off, swift as a hawk, toward the hills upon the left. Pommers had met his match that day. The white horse, two parts Arab, bore the lighter weight, since Nigel was clad in full armour. For 5 miles over the open, neither gained 100 yards upon the other. They had topped the hill and flew down the further side, the stranger continually turning in his saddle to have a look at his pursuer. There was no panic in his flight, but rather the amused rivalry with which a good horseman who is proud of his mount contends with one who has challenged him. Below the hill was a marshy plain, studded with great druidic stones, some prostrate, some erect, some bearing others across their tops like the huge doors of some vanished building. A path ran through the marsh with green rushes as a danger signal on either side of it. Across this path many of the huge stones were lying, but the white horse cleared them in its stride, and Pommers followed close upon his heels. Then came a mile of soft ground, where the lighter weight again drew to the front, but it ended in a dry upland, and once again Nigel gained. A sunken road crossed it, but the white cleared it with a mighty spring, and again the yellow followed. 2 small hills lay before them, with a narrow gorge of deep bushes between. Nigel saw the white horse bounding chest-deep amid the underwood. Next instant, its hind legs were high in the air, and the rider had been shot from its back. A howl of triumph rose from amidst the bushes, and a dozen wild figures, armed with club and with spear, rushed upon the prostrate man. "À moi, Anglais, à moi!" cried a voice, and Nigel saw the young rider stagger to his feet, strike round him with his sword, and then fall once more before the rush of his assailants. There was a comradeship amongst men of gentle blood and bearing, which banded them together against all ruffianly or unchivalrous attack. These rude fellows were no soldiers. Their dress and arms, their uncouth cries and wild assault, marked them as banditti, such men as had slain the Englishmen upon the road. Waiting in narrow gorges with a hidden rope across the path, they watched for the lonely horseman as a fowler waits by his bird-trap, trusting that they could overthrow the steed and then slay the rider ere he had recovered from his fall. Such would have been the fate of the stranger, as of so many cavaliers before him, had Nigel not chanced to be close upon his heels. In an instant Pommers had burst through the group who had struck at the prostrate man, and in another 2 of the robbers had fallen before Nigel's sword. A spear rang on his breastplate, but 1 blow shore off its head, and a second that of him who held it. In vain they thrust at the steel-girt man. His sword played round them like lightning, and the fierce horse ramped and swooped above them with pawing iron-shod hoofs and eyes of fire. With cries and shrieks they flew off to right and left amidst the bushes, springing over boulders and darting under branches where no horseman could follow them. The foul crew had gone as swiftly and suddenly as it had come, and save for 4 ragged figures littered amongst the trampled bushes, no sign remained of their passing. Nigel tethered Pommers to a thorn bush, and then turned his attention to the injured man. The white horse had regained his feet and stood whinnying gently as he looked down on his prostrate master. A heavy blow, half broken by his sword, had beaten him down and left a great raw bruise upon his forehead. But a stream gurgled through the gorge, and a capful of water dashed over his face brought the senses back to the injured man. He was a mere stripling, with the delicate features of a woman and a pair of great violet-blue eyes which looked up presently with a puzzled stare into Nigel's face.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"Ah, yes, I call you to mind. You are the young Englishman who chased me on the great yellow horse. By Our Lady of Rocamadour, whose vernicle is around my neck, I could not have believed that any horse could have kept at the heels of Charlemagne so long. But I will wager you 100 crowns, Englishman, that I lead you over a 5-mile course." "Nay," said Nigel, "we will wait till you can back a horse ere we talk of racing it. I am Nigel of Tilford, of the family of Loring, a squire by rank, and the son of a knight. How are you called, young sir?"
"I also am a squire by rank, and the son of a knight. I am Raoul de la Roche, Pierre de Bras, whose father writes himself Lord of Grosbois,
a free vavasseur of the noble Count of Toulouse, and the right of Fossa and of Fourca, the high justice, the middle, and the low. He sat up and rubbed his eyes. Englishman, you have saved my life, as I would have saved yours had I seen such yelping dogs set upon a man of blood and of coat armor. But now I am yours. And what is your sweet will? When you are fit to ride, you will come back with me to my people. Alas, I feared that you would say so. Had I taken you, Nigel, that is your name, is it not? Had I taken you, I would not have acted thus. How then would you have ordered things? Asked Nigel, much taken with the frank and debonair manner of his captive. I would not have taken advantage of such a mischance as has befallen me, which has put me in your power. I would have given you a sword, and beat you in a fair fight, so that I might send you to give greeting to my dear lady, and show her the deeds which I do for her fair sake. Indeed, your words are both good and fair, said Nigel. By St. Paul, I cannot call to mind that I have ever met a man who bore himself better. But since I am in my armor and you without, I see not how we can debate the matter. Surely, gentle Nigel, you could doff your armor. Then have I only my underclothes? Nay, there shall be no unfairness there, for I also will very gladly strip to my underclothes. Nigel looked wistfully at the Frenchman, but he shook his head. Alas, it may not be, said he. The last words that Sir Robert said to me were that I was to bring you to his side, for he would have speech with you. Would that I could do what you ask, for I also have a fair lady to whom I would fain send you. What use are you to me, Royal, since I have gained no honor in the taking of you? How is it with you now? The young Frenchman had risen to his feet. Do not take my sword, he said. I am yours, rescue or no rescue. I think now that I could mount my horse, though indeed my head still rings like a cracked bell. Nigel had lost all traces of his comrades, but he remembered Sir Robert's words that he should ride upon the sun, with the certainty that sooner or later he would strike upon the road. As they jogged slowly along over undulating hills, the Frenchman shook off his hurt, and the two chatted merrily together. "I had but just come to France," said he, "and I had hoped to win honor in this country, for I have ever heard that the English are very hardy men and excellent people to fight with. My mules and my baggage are at Evron, but I rode forth to see what I could see, and I chanced upon your army moving down the road, so I coasted it in the hopes of some profit or adventure. Then you came after me, and I would have given all the gold goblets upon my father's table if I had my harness, so that I could have turned upon you. I have promised the Countess Beatrice that I will send her an Englishman or two to kiss her hands." "One might perchance have a worse fate," said Nigel. "Is this fair dame your betrothed?" "She is my love," answered the Frenchman. "We are but waiting for the Count to be slain in the wars, and then we mean to marry. And this lady of thine, Nigel, I would that I could see her." "Perchance you shall, fair sir," said Nigel, "for all that I have seen of you fills me with a desire to go further with you. It is in my mind that we might turn this thing to profit and to honor, for when Sir Robert has spoken with you, I am free to do with you as I will." "And what will you do, Nigel?" "We shall surely try some small deed upon each other, so that either I shall see the Lady Beatrice, or you the Lady Mary. Nay, thank me not, for like yourself, I have come to this country in search of honor, and I know not where I may better find it than at the end of your sword point. My good lord and master, Sir John Chandos, has told me many times that never yet did he meet French knight nor squire that he did not find great pleasure and profit from their company, and now I very clearly see that he has spoken the truth." For an hour these two friends rode together, the Frenchman pouring forth the praises of his lady, whose glove he produced from one pocket, her garter from his vest, and her shoe from his saddlebag. She was blonde, and when he heard that Mary was dark, he would fain stop then and there to fight the question of colour. He talked, too, of his great chateau at Lota, by the headwaters of the pleasant Garonne, of the 100 horses in the stables, and the 70 hounds in the kennels, the 50 hawks in the mews. His English friend should come there when the wars were over, and what golden days would be theirs! Nigel, too, with his English coldness thawing before this young sunbeam of the south, found himself talking of the heather slopes of Surrey, of the forest of Woolmer, even of the sacred chambers of Cosford. But as they rode onward towards the sinking sun, their thoughts far away in their distant homes, their horses striding together,
there came that which brought their minds back in an instant to the perilous hillsides of Brittany. It was the long blast of a trumpet, blown from somewhere on the farther side of a ridge towards which they were riding. A second long-drawn note from a distance answered it. "It is your camp," said the Frenchman. "Nay," said Nigel, "we have pipes with us and a naker or two, but I have heard no trumpet call from our ranks. It behooves us to take heed, for we know not what may be before us. Ride this way, I pray you, that we may look over and yet ourselves be unseen." Some scattered boulders crowned the height, and from behind them the two young squires could see the long rocky valley beyond. Upon a knoll was a small square building with a battlement round it. Some distance from it towered a great dark castle, as massive as the rocks on which it stood, with one strong keep at the corner and four long lines of machicolated walls. Above, a great banner flew proudly in the wind, with some device which glowed red in the setting sun. Nigel shaded his eyes and stared with a wrinkled brow. "It is not the arms of England, nor yet the lilies of France, nor is it the ermine of Brittany," said he. "He who holds this castle fights for his own hand, since his own device flies above it. Surely it is a head Jules on an argent field." "The bloody head on a silver tray," cried the Frenchman. "Was I not warned against him? This is not a man, friend Nigel. It is a monster who wars upon English, French, and all Christendom. Have you not heard of the butcher of La Brohiniere?"
"Nay, I have not heard of him."
"His name is accursed in France. Have I not been told also that he put to death this very year Gilles de Saint-Pol, a friend of the English king?"
"Yes, in very truth it comes back to my mind now that I heard something of this matter in Calais before we started."
"There he dwells, and God guard you if ever you pass under yonder portal, for no prisoner has ever come forth alive. Since these wars began he has been a king to himself, and the plunder of 11 years lies in yonder cellars. How can justice come to him when no man knows who owns the land? But when we have packed you all back to your island, by the blessed Mother of God, we have a heavy debt to pay to the man who dwells in yonder pile." But even as they watched, the trumpet call burst forth once more. It came not from the castle, but from the farther end of the valley. It was answered by a second call from the walls. Then, in a long, straggling line, there came a wild troop of marauders, streaming homeward from some foray. In the van, at the head of a body of spearmen, rode a tall and burly man, clad in brazen armor, so that he shone like a golden image in the slanting rays of the sun. His helmet had been loosened from his gorget, and was held before him on his horse's neck. A great tangled beard flowed over his breastplate, and his hair hung down as far behind. A squire at his elbow bore high the banner of the bleeding head. Behind the spearmen were a line of heavily laden mules, and on either side of them a drove of poor country folk who were being herded into the castle. Lastly came a second strong troop of mounted spearmen, who conducted a score or more of prisoners who marched together in a solid body. Nigel stared at them, and then, springing on his horse, he urged it along the shelter of the ridge so as to reach unseen a spot which was close to the castle gate. He had scarce taken up his new position when the cavalcade reached the drawbridge, and amid yells of welcome from those upon the wall, filed in a thin line across it. Nigel stared hard once more at the prisoners in the rear, and so absorbed was he by the sight that he had passed the rocks and was standing sheer upon the summit. "By St. Paul," he cried, "it must indeed be so. I see their russet jackets. They are English archers." As he spoke, the hindmost one, a strongly built, broad-shouldered man, looked round and saw the gleaming figure above him upon the hill, with open helmet and the five roses glowing upon his breast. With a sweep of his hands, he had thrust his guardians aside, and for a moment was clear of the throng.
"Squire Loring! Squire Loring!" he cried. "It is I, Aylward the archer! It is I, Samkin Aylward!"
The next minute a dozen hands had seized him. His cries were muffled with a gag, and he was hurled, the last of the band, through the black and threatening archway of the gate. Then, with a clang, the two iron wings came together. The portcullis swung upward, and captives and captors, robbers and booty, were all swallowed up within the grim and silent fortress.
End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 20. How the English attempted the castle of La Brohiniere. For some minutes Nigel remained motionless upon the crest of the hill, his heart like lead within him, and his eyes fixed upon the huge grey walls which contained his unhappy henchmen. He was roused by a sympathetic hand upon his shoulder, and the voice of his young prisoner in his ear.
"Pest!" said he. "They have some of your birds in their cage, have they not?" "What then, my friend? Keep your heart high. Is it not the chance of war? Today them, tomorrow thee, and death at last for us all? And yet I had rather they were in any hands than those of Oliver the Butcher." "By St. Paul, we cannot suffer it!" cried Nigel distractedly. "This man has come with me from my own home. He has stood between me and death before now. It goes to my very heart that he should call upon me in vain. I pray you, Raoul, to use your wits, for mine are all curdled in my head. Tell me what I should do, and how I may bring him help."
The Frenchman shrugged his shoulders. "As easy to get a lamb unscathed out of a wolf's lair as a prisoner safe from La Brohiniere. Nay, Nigel, whither do you go? Have you indeed taken leave of your wits?" The squire had spurred his horse down the hillside and never halted until he was within a bowshot of the gate. The French prisoner followed hard behind him with a buzz of reproaches and expostulations. "You are mad, Nigel," he cried. "What do you hope to do then? Would you carry the castle with your own hands? Halt, man, halt in the name of the Virgin!" But Nigel had no plan in his head and only obeyed the fevered impulse to do something to ease his thoughts. He paced his horse up and down, waving his spear and shouting insults and challenges to the garrison. Over the high wall 100 jeering faces looked down upon him. So rash and wild was his action that it seemed to those within to mean some trap, so the drawbridge was still held high, and none ventured forth to seize him. A few long-range arrows pattered on the rocks, and then, with a deep, booming sound, a huge stone, hurled from a mangonel, sang over the head of the two squires and crushed into splinters among the boulders behind them. The Frenchman seized Nigel's bridle and forced him further from the gateway. "By the dear Virgin," he cried, "I care not to have those pebbles around my ears, yet I cannot go back alone, so it is very clear, my crazed comrade, that you must come also. Now we are beyond their reach. But see, my friend Nigel, who are those who crown the height?" The sun had sunk behind the western ridge, but the glowing sky was fringed at its lower edge by a score of ruddy twinkling points. A body of horsemen showed hard and black upon the bare hill. Then they dipped down the slope into the valley, whilst a band of footmen followed behind. "They are my people," cried Nigel joyously. "Come, my friend, hasten that we may take counsel what we should do." Sir Robert Knolles rode a bowshot in front of his men, and his brow was as black as night. Beside him, with crestfallen face, his horse bleeding, his armour dinted and soiled, was the hot-headed knight, Sir James Astley. A fierce discussion raged between them. "I have done my devoir as best I might," said Astley. "Alone I had 10 of them at my sword-point. I know not how I have lived to tell it."
"What is your devoir to me? Where are my 30 bowmen?" cried Knolles in bitter wrath. 10 lie dead upon the ground, and 20 are worse than dead in yonder castle. And all because you must needs show all men how bold you are, and ride into a bushman such as a child could see. Alas, for my own folly that ever I should have trusted such a one as you with the handling of men."
"By God, Sir Robert, you shall answer to me for those words," cried Astley with a choking voice. "Never has a man dared to speak to me as you have done this day.
As long as I hold the king's order, I shall be master, and by the Lord I shall hang you, James, on a near tree if I have further cause of offence. How now, Nigel? I see by yonder white horse that you at least have not failed me. I will speak with you anon. Percy, bring up your men, and let us gather round this castle, for, as I hope for my soul's salvation, I will not leave until I have my archers, or the head of him who holds them."
That night the English lay thick round the fortress of La Brouinière, so that none might come forth from it. But if none could come forth, it was hard to see how any could win their way in, for it was full of men, the walls were high and strong, and a deep, dry ditch girt it round. But the hatred and the fear which its master had raised over the whole countryside could now be plainly seen, for during the night the brushwood men and the villagers came in from all parts with offers of such help as they could give for the intaking of the castle. Knolles set them cutting bushes and tying them into faggots. When morning came, he rode out before the wall, and he held counsel with his knights and squires as to how he should enter in. "By noon," said he, "we shall have so many faggots that we may make our way over the ditch. Then we will beat in the gates, and so win a footing." The young Frenchman had come with Nigel to the conference, and now, amid the silence which followed the leader's proposal, he asked if he might be heard. He was clad in the brazen armor which Nigel had taken from the Red Ferret. "It may be that it is not for me to join in your council," said he, "seeing that I am a prisoner and a Frenchman. But this man is the enemy of all, and we of France owe him a debt even as you do, since many a good Frenchman has died in his cellars. For this reason I crave to be heard." "We will hear you," said Knolles. "I have come from Evrin yesterday," said he. "Sir Henry Spinfor, Sir Peter Leroy, and many other brave knights and squires lie there, with a good company of men, all of whom would very gladly join with you to destroy this butcher and his castle. For it is well known amongst us that his deeds are neither good nor fair. There are also bombards which we could drag over the hills, and so beat down this iron gate. If you so order it, I will ride to Evrin and bring my companions back with me."
"Indeed, Robert," said Percy, "it is in my mind that this Frenchman speaks very wisely and well."
"And when we have taken the castle, what then?" asked Knolles.
"Then you could go upon your way, fair sir, and we upon ours. Or, if it please you better, you could draw together on yonder hill, and we on this one, so that the valley lies between us. Then, if any cavalier wished to advance himself, or to shed a vow and exalt his lady, an opening might be found for him. Surely it would be shame if so many brave men drew together, and no small deed were to come of it."
Nigel clasped his captive's hand to show his admiration and esteem, but Knolles shook his head.
"Things are not ordered thus, save in the tales of the minstrels," said he. "I have no wish that your people at Evrin should know our numbers and our plans. I am not in this land for knight-errantry, but I am here to make head against the king's enemies. Has no one aught else to say?"
Percy pointed to the small outlying Fort Elise upon the knoll, on which also flew the flag of the Bloody Head.
"This smaller castle, Robert, is of no great strength, and cannot hold more than 50 men. It is built, as I conceive it, that no one should seize the high ground and shoot down into the other. Why should we not turn all our strength upon it, since it is the weaker of the twain?"
But again the young leader shook his head.
"If I should take it," said he, "I am still no nearer to my desire, nor will it avail me in getting back my bowmen. It may cost a score of men, and what profit shall I have from it? Had I bombards, I might place them on yonder hill, but having none, it is of little use to me."
"It may be," said Nigel, "that they have scant food or water, and so must come forth to fight us."
"I have made inquiry of the peasants," Knolles answered, "and they are of one mind that there is a well within the castle and a great store of food. Nay, gentlemen, there is no way before us save to take it by arms, and no spot where we can attempt it save through the great gate. Soon we will have so many faggots that we can cast them down into the ditch and so win our way across. I have ordered them to cut a pine tree on the hill and shear the branches so that we may beat down the gate with it. But what is now amiss, and why do they run forward to the castle?" A buzz had risen from the soldiers in the camp, and they all crowded in one direction, rushing toward the castle wall. The knights and squires rode after them, and when in view of the main gate, the cause of the disturbance lay before them. On the tower above the portal, three men were standing in the garb of English archers, ropes round their necks and their hands bound behind them. Their comrades surged below them with cries of recognition and of pity.
"It is Ambrose," cried one. "Surely it is Ambrose of Ingleton."
"Yes, in truth, I see his yellow hair. And the other, him with the beard, it is Lockwood of Skipton. Alas for his wife who keeps the booth by the bridgehead of Ribble. I wot not who the third may be."
"It is little Johnny Allspay, the youngest man in the company," cried old Wat, with the tears running down his cheeks. "'Twas I who brought him from his home. Alas, alas! Foul fare the day that ever I coaxed him from his mother's side, that he might perish in a far land." There was a sudden flourish of a trumpet, and the drawbridge fell. Across it strode a portly man with a faded herald's coat. He halted warily upon the farther side, and his voice boomed like a drum.
"I would speak with your leader," he cried.
Knolles rode forward. "Have I your knightly word that I may advance unscathed with all courteous entreaty as befits a herald?" Knolles nodded his head. The man came slowly and pompously forward.
"I am the messenger and liege servant," said he, "of the high baron Oliver de Saint-Yvon, lord of La Brohiniere. He bids me to say that if you continue your journey and molest him no further, he will engage upon his part to make no further attack upon you. As to the men whom he holds, he will enroll them in his own honorable service, for he has need of longbowmen and has heard much of their skill. But if you constrain him or cause him further displeasure by remaining before his castle, he hereby gives you warning that he will hang these three men over his gateway, and every morning another three, until all have been slain. This he has sworn upon the rood of Calvary, and as he has said, so he will do upon jeopardy of his soul."
Robert Knolles looked grimly at the messenger.
"You may thank the saints that you have my promise," said he. "Else would I have stripped that lying tabard from thy back, and the skin beneath it from thy bones, that thy master might have a fitting answer to his message. Tell him that I hold him and all that are within his castle as hostage for the lives of my men, and that, should he dare to do them scathe, he and every man that is with him shall hang upon his battlements. Go, and go quickly, lest my patience fail."
There was that in Knolles' cold grey eyes, and in his manner of speaking those last words, which sent the portly envoy back at a quicker gait than he had come. As he vanished into the gloomy arch of the gateway, the drawbridge swung up with a creak and a rattle behind him. A few minutes later, a rough-bearded fellow stepped out over the portal where the condemned archers stood, and seizing the first by the shoulders, he thrust him over the wall. A cry burst from the man's lips, and a deep groan from those of his comrades below, as he fell with a jerk, which sent him halfway up to the parapet again, and then, after dancing like a child's toy, swung slowly backward and forward, with limp limbs and twisted neck. The hangman turned and bowed in mock reverence to the spectators beneath him. He had not yet learned in a land of puny archers how sure and how strong is the English bow. Half a dozen men, Old Wat amongst them, had run forward toward the wall. They were too late to save their comrades, but at least their deaths were speedily avenged. The man was in the act of pushing off the second prisoner when an arrow crashed through his head, and he fell stone dead upon the parapet. But even in falling he had given the fatal thrust, and a second russet figure swung beside the first against the dark background of the castle wall. There only remained the young lad, Johnny Allspay, who stood shaking with fear, an abyss below him and the voices of those who would hurl him over it behind. There was a long pause before anyone would come forth to dare those deadly arrows. Then a fellow, crouching double, ran forward from the shelter, keeping the young archer's body as a shield between him and danger.
"Aside, John, aside!" cried his comrades from below.
The youth sprang as far as the rope would allow him, and slipped it half over his face in the effort. Three arrows flashed past his side, and two of them buried themselves in the body of the man behind. A howl of delight burst from the spectators as he dropped first upon his knees, and then upon his face. A life for a life was no bad bargain. But it was only a short respite which the skill of his comrades had given to the young archer. Over the parapet there appeared a ball of brass, then a pair of great brazen shoulders, and lastly the full figure of an armoured man. He walked to the edge, and they heard his hoarse guffaw of laughter as the arrows clanged and clattered against his impenetrable mail. He slapped his breastplate as he jeered at them. Well he knew that at the distance no dart ever sped by mortal hands could cleave through his plates of metal. So he stood, the great burly butcher of La Brohiniere, with head uptossed, laughing insolently at his foes. Then, with slow and ponderous tread, he walked towards his boy victim, seized him by the ear, and dragged him across so that the rope might be straight. Seeing that the noose had slipped across the face, he tried to push it down, but the mailed glove hampering him, he pulled it off
and grasped the rope above the lad's head with his naked hand. Quick as a flash, old Wat's arrow had sped, and the butcher sprang back with a howl of pain, his hand skewered by a clothyard shaft. As he shook it furiously at his enemies, a second grazed his knuckles. With a brutal kick of his metal-shod feet, he hurled young Allspay over the edge, looked down for a few moments at his death agonies, and then walked slowly from the parapet, nursing his dripping hand, the arrow still ringing loudly upon his backpiece as he went. The archers below, enraged at the death of their comrades, leapt and howled like a pack of ravening wolves. "By St. Dunstan," said Percy, looking round at their flushed faces, "if ever we are to carry it, now is the moment, for these men will not be stopped if hate can take them forward."
"You are right, Thomas," cried Knolles. "Gather together 20 men-at-arms, each with his shield to cover him. Astley, do you place the bowmen so that no head may show at window or parapet? Nigel, I pray you to order the country folk forward with their fardels of faggots. Let the others bring up the lopped pine trees which lies yonder behind the horse lines. 10 men-at-arms can bear it on the right, and 10 on the left, having shields over their heads. The gate once down, let every man rush in, and God help the better cause."
Swiftly and yet quietly the dispositions were made, for these were old soldiers whose daily trade was war. In little groups the archers formed in front of each slit or crevice in the walls, whilst others scanned the battlements with wary eyes and sped an arrow at every face which gleamed for an instant above them. The garrison shot forth a shower of crossbow bolts and an occasional stone from their engine, but so deadly was the hail which rained upon them that they had no time to dwell upon their aim, and their discharges were wild and harmless. Under cover of the shafts of the bowmen, a line of peasants ran unscathed to the edge of the ditch, each hurling in the bundle which he bore in his arms, and then hurrying back for another one. In 20 minutes a broad pathway of faggots lay level with the ground upon one side and the gate upon the other. With the loss of 2 peasants slain by bolts and 1 archer crushed by a stone, the ditch had been filled up. All was ready for the battering ram. With a shout, 20 picked men rushed forward with the pine tree under their arms, the heavy end turned towards the gate. The arbalesters on the tower leaned over and shot into the midst of them, but could not stop their advance. 2 dropped, but the others, raising their shields, ran onward, still shouting, crossed the bridge of faggots, and came with a thundering crash against the door. It splintered from base to arch, but kept its place. Swinging their mighty weapon, the storming party thudded and crashed upon the gate, every blow loosening and widening the cracks which rent it from end to end. The 3 knights, with Nigel, the Frenchman Raoul, and the other squires, stood beside the ram, cheering on the men, and chanting to the rhythm of the swing with a loud "Ha!" at every blow. A great stone loosened from the parapet roared through the air and struck Sir James Astley and another of the attackers. But Nigel and the Frenchman had taken their places in an instant, and the ram thudded and smashed with greater energy than ever. Another blow, and another. The lower part was staving inward, but the great central bar still held firm. Surely another minute would beat it from its sockets. But suddenly from above there came a great deluge of liquid. A hogshead of it had been tilted from the battlements until soldiers, bridge, and ram were equally drenched in yellow slime. Knolles rubbed his gauntlet in it, held it to his visor, and smelled it. "Back! Back!" he cried. "Back before it is too late!" There was a small barred window above their heads at the side of the gate. A ruddy glare shone through it, and then a blazing torch was tossed down upon them. In a moment the oil had caught, and the whole place was a sheet of flame. The fir tree they carried, the faggots beneath them, their very weapons were all in a blaze. To right and left the men sprang down into the dry ditch, rolling with screams upon the ground in their endeavour to extinguish the flames. The knights and squires, protected by their armour, strove hard, stamping and slapping, to each of those who had but leather jacks to shield their bodies. From above, a ceaseless shower of darts and of stones were poured down upon them, whilst on the other hand the archers, seeing the greatness of the danger, ran up to the edge of the ditch and shot fast and true at every face which showed above the wall. Scorched, wearied, and bedraggled, the remains of the storming party clambered out of the ditch as best they could, clutching at the friendly hands held down to them, and so limped their way back amid the taunts and howls of their enemies. A long pile of smouldering cinders was all that remained of their bridge, and on it lay Astley and 6 other red-hot men glowing in their armour. Knolles clinched his hands as he looked back at the ruin that was wrought, and then surveyed the group of men who stood or lay around him, nursing their burned limbs, and scowling up at the exultant figures who waved on the castle wall. Badly scorched himself, the young leader had no thought for his own injuries and the rage and grief which racked his soul. "We will build another bridge," he cried. "Set the peasants binding faggots once more." But a thought had flashed through Nigel's mind. "See, fair sir," said he, "the nails of yonder door are red hot, and the wood as white as ashes. Surely we can break our way through it." "By the Virgin, you speak truly," cried the French squire. "If we can cross the ditch, the gate will not stop us. Come, Nigel, for our fair lady's sakes, I will race you who will reach it first, England or France." Alas for all the wise words of the good Chandos! Alas for all the lessons in order and discipline learned from the wary Knolles! In an instant, forgetful of all things but this noble challenge, Nigel was running at the top of his speed for the burning gate. Close at his heels was the Frenchman, blowing and gasping as he rushed along in his brazen armor. Behind came a stream of howling archers and men-at-arms, like a flood which has broken its dam. Down they slipped into the ditch, rushed across it, and clambered on each other's backs up the opposite side. Nigel, Raoul, and two archers gained a foothold in front of the burning gate at the same moment. With blows and kicks they burst it to pieces, and dashed with a yell of triumph through the dark archway beyond. For a moment they thought with mad rapture that the castle was carried. A dark tunnel lay before them, down which they rushed. But alas, at the farther end it was blocked by a second gateway, as strong as that which had been burned. In vain they beat upon it with their swords and axes. On each side the tunnel was pierced with slits, and the crossbow bolts, discharged at only a few yards' distance, crashed through armor as if it were cloth, and laid man after man upon the stones. They raged and leapt before the great iron-clamped barrier, but the wall itself was as easy to tear down. It was bitter to draw back, but it was madness to remain. Nigel looked round and saw that half his men were down. At the same moment Raoul sank with a gasp at his feet, a bolt driven to its socket through the links of the camail which guarded his neck. Some of the archers, seeing that certain death awaited them, were already running back to escape from the fatal passage. "By St. Paul," cried Nigel hotly, "would you leave our wounded where this butcher may lay his hands upon them? Let the archers shoot inwards and hold them back from the slits. Now, let each man raise one of our comrades, lest we leave our honour in the gate of this castle." With a mighty effort he had raised Raoul upon his shoulders and staggered with him to the edge of the ditch. Several men were waiting below where the steep bank shielded them from the arrows, and to them Nigel handed down his wounded friend, and each archer in turn did the same. Again and again Nigel went back until no one lay in the tunnel save seven who had died there. 13 wounded were laid in the shelter of the ditch, and there they must remain until night came to cover them. Meanwhile the bowmen on the farther side protected them from attack, and also prevented the enemy from all attempts to build up the outer gate. The gaping, smoke-blackened arch was all that they could show for a loss of 30 men. But that, at least, Knolles was determined to keep. Burned and bruised, but unconscious of either pain or fatigue for the turmoil of his spirit within him, Nigel knelt by the Frenchman and loosed his helmet. The girlish face of the young squire was white as chalk, and the haze of death was gathering over his violet eyes, but a faint smile played round his lips as he looked up at his English comrade. "I shall never see Beatrice again," he whispered. "I pray you, Nigel, that when there is a truce you will journey as far as my father's chateau and tell him how his son died. Young Gaston will rejoice, for to him come the land and the coat, the war-cry and the prophet. See them, Nigel, and tell them that I was as forward as the others." "Indeed, Raoul, no man could have carried himself with more honor or won more worship than you have done this day. I will do your behest when the time comes." "Surely you are happy, Nigel," the dying squire murmured, "for this day has given you one more deed which you may lay at the feet of your lady love." "It might be so had we carried the gate," Nigel answered sadly. "But by St. Paul, I cannot count it a deed where I have come back with my purpose unfulfilled. But this is no time, Raoul, to talk of my small affairs. If we take the castle, and I bear a good part of it, then perchance all this may indeed avail." The Frenchman sat up with that strange energy which comes often as the harbinger of death. "You will win your Lady Mary, Nigel, and your great deeds will not be three, but a score. so that in all Christendom there shall be no man of blood and coat armor who has not heard your name and your fame. This I tell you, I, Raoul de la Roche, Pierre de la Bras, dying upon the field of honor. And now kiss me, sweet friend, and lay me back, for the mists close around me, and I am gone. With tender hands, the squire lowered his comrade's head. But even as he did so, there came a choking rush of blood, and the soul had passed. So died a gallant cavalier of France. And Nigel, as he knelt in the ditch beside him, prayed that his own end might be as noble and as debonair. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 21. How the Second Messenger Went to Cosford. Under cover of night, the wounded men were lifted from the ditch and carried back, whilst pickets of archers were advanced to the very gate so that none should rebuild it. Nigel, sick at heart over his own failure, the death of his prisoner, and his fears for Aylward, crept back into camp, but his cup was not yet full, for Knolles was waiting for him with a tongue which cut like a whiplash. Who was he, a raw squire, that he should lead an attack without orders? See what his crazy knight-errantry had brought about? 20 men had been destroyed by it, and nothing gained. Their blood was on his head. Chandos should hear of his conduct. He should be sent back to England when the castle had fallen. Such were the bitter words of Knolles, the more bitter because Nigel felt in his heart that he had indeed done wrong, and that Chandos would have said the same, though perchance in kinder words. He listened in silent respect, as his duty was, and then, having saluted his leader, he withdrew apart, threw himself down amongst the bushes, and wept the hottest tears of his life, sobbing bitterly with his face between his hands. He had striven hard, and yet everything had gone wrong with him. He was bruised, burned, and aching from head to foot. Yet so high is the spirit above the body that all was nothing compared to the sorrow and shame which racked his soul. But a little thing changed the current of his thoughts and brought some peace to his mind. He had slipped off his mail gauntlets, and as he did so, his fingers lighted upon the tiny bangle which Mary had fastened there when they stood together upon St. Catherine's Hill on the Guildford Road. He remembered the motto, curiously worked in filigree of gold. It ran, "Fais ce que dois, advienne que pourra, c'est commande au chevalier." The words rang in his weary brain. He had done what seemed right, come what might. It had gone awry, it is true, but all things human may do that. If he had carried the castle, he felt that Knolles would have forgiven and forgotten all else. If he had not carried it, it was no fault of his. No man could have done more. If Mary could see, she would surely have approved. Dropping into sleep, he saw her dark face, shining with pride and with pity, stooping over him as he lay. She stretched out her hand in his dream and touched him on the shoulder. He sprang up and rubbed his eyes, for the fact had woven itself into dream in the strange way that it does, and someone was indeed leaning over him in the gloom and shaking him from his slumbers. But the gentle voice and soft touch of the Lady Mary had changed suddenly to the harsh accents and rough grip of Black Simon, the fierce Norfolk man-at-arms. "Surely you are Squire Loring," he said, peering close to his face in the darkness. "I am he. What then?"
"I have searched through the camp for you, but when I saw the great horse tethered near the bushes, I thought you would be found hard by. I have a word with you."
"Speak on."
"This man Aylward, the bowman, was my friend, and it is the nature that God has given me to love my friends even as I hate my foes. He is also thy servant, and it has seemed to me that you love him also."
"I have good cause to do so."
"Then you and I, Squire Loring, have more reason to strive on his behalf than any of these others, who think more of taking the castle than of saving those who are captives within. Do you not see that such a man as this robber lord would,
when all else had failed him, most surely cut the throats of his prisoners at the last instant before the castle fell, knowing well that, come what might, he would have short shrift himself. Is that not certain?
By St. Paul, I had not thought of it.
I was with you, hammering at the inner gate, said Simon, and yet once, when I thought that it was giving way, I said in my heart, Goodbye, Samkin, I shall never see you more. This baron has gall in his soul, even as I have myself. Do you think that I would give up my prisoners alive, if I were constrained so to do? No, no. Had we won our way this day, it would have been the death stroke for them all.
It may be that you are right, Simon, said Nigel,
and the thought of it should assuage our grief. But if we cannot save them by taking the castle, then surely they are lost indeed.
It may be so, or it may not, Simon answered slowly. It is in my mind that if the castle were taken very suddenly, and in such a fashion that they could not foresee it, then perchance we might get the prisoners before they could do them scathe.
Nigel bent forward eagerly, his hand on the soldier's arm. You have some plan in your mind, Simon. Tell me what it is.
I had wished to tell Sir Robert, but he is preparing the assault for tomorrow, and would not be turned from his purpose. I have indeed a plan, but whether it be good or not, I cannot say until I have tried it. But first, I will tell you what put it into my thoughts. Know then that this morning, when I was in yonder ditch, I marked one of their men upon the wall. He was a big man, with a white face, red hair, and a touch of St. Anthony's fire upon the cheek. But what has this to do with Aylward? I will show you. This evening, after the assault, I chanced to walk with some of my fellows round yonder small fort upon the knoll to see if we could spy a weak spot in it. Some of them came to the wall to curse us, and among them, whom should I see but a big man with a white face, red hair, and a touch of St. Anthony's fire upon his cheek.
What make you of that, Squire Nigel?
That this man had crossed from the castle to the fort.
In good sooth, it must indeed be so. There are not two such ken-speckled men in the world. But if he crossed from the castle to the fort, it was not above the ground, for our own people were between.
By St. Paul, I see your meaning, cried Nigel. It is in your mind that there is a passage under the earth from one to the other.
I am well sure of it.
Then if we should take the small fort, we may pass down this tunnel and so carry the great castle also.
Such a thing might happen, said Simon, and yet it is dangerous also, for surely those in the castle would hear our assault upon the fort, and so be warned to bar the passage against us, and to slay the prisoners before we should come.
What then is your rede?
Could we find where the tunnel lay, Squire Nigel? I know not what is to prevent us from digging down upon it, and breaking into it, so that both fort and castle are at our mercy before either knows that we are there.
Nigel clapped his hands with joy. "'For God!' he cried. "'It is a most noble plan. But alas, Simon, I see not how we can tell the course of this passage, or where we should dig.'
"'I have peasants yonder with spades,' said Simon. "'There are two of my friends, Harding of Barnstable and West Country John, who are waiting for us with their gear.' If you will come to lead us, Squire Nigel, we are ready to venture our bodies in the attempt. What would Noll say in case they failed?
The thought flashed through Nigel's mind, but another came swiftly behind it.
He would not venture further unless he found hopes of success. If he did venture further, he would put his life upon it. Giving that, he made amends for all errors. And if, on the other hand, success crowned their efforts, then Noll's would forgive his failure at the gateway. A minute later, every doubt banished from his mind, he was making his way through the darkness under the guidance of Black Simon. Outside the camp, the two other men-at-arms were waiting for them, and the four advanced together. Presently, a little group of figures loomed up in the darkness. It was a cloudy night, and a thin rain was falling which obscured both the castle and the fort, but a stone had been placed by Simon in the daytime, which assured that they were between the two.
"'Is Blind Andreas there?' asked Simon.
"'Yes, kind sir, I am here,' said a voice.
"'This man,' said Simon, "'was once rich and of good repute, "'but he was beggared by this robber lord, "'who afterwards put out his eyes "'so that he has lived for many years in darkness "'at the charity of others.
"'How can he help us in our enterprise "'if he be indeed blind?' asked Nigel.
"It is for that very reason, fair lord, that he can be of greater service than any other man," Simon answered. "For it often happens that when a man has lost a sense, the good God will strengthen those that remain. Hence it is that Andreas has such ears that he can hear the sap in the trees or the cheep of the mouse in its burrow. He has come to help us find the tunnel."
"And I have found it," said the blind man proudly. "Here I have placed my staff upon the line of it. Twice, as I lay there with my ear to the ground, I have heard footsteps pass beneath me."
"I trust you make no mistake, old man," said Nigel. For answer, the blind man raised his staff and smote twice upon the ground, once to the right and once to the left. The one gave a dull thud, the other a hollow boom.
"Can you not hear that?" he asked. "Will you ask me now if I make mistake?"
"Indeed, we are much beholden to you," cried Nigel. "Let the peasants dig then, and as silently as they may. Do you keep your ear upon the ground, Andreas, so that if anyone pass beneath us we shall be warned." So, amid the driving rain, the little group toiled in the darkness. The blind man lay silent, flat upon his face, and twice they heard his warning hiss and stopped their work, whilst someone passed beneath. In an hour they had dug down to a stone arch, which was clearly the outer side of the tunnel roof. Here was a sad obstacle, for it might take long to loosen a stone, and if the work was not done by the break of day, then their enterprise was indeed hopeless. They loosened the mortar with a dagger, and at last dislodged one small stone, which enabled them to get at the others. Presently, a dark hole, blacker than the night around them, yawned at their feet, and their swords could touch no bottom to it. They had opened the tunnel.
"I would fain enter it first," said Nigel. "I pray you to lower me down." They held him to the full length of their arms, and then, letting him drop, they heard him land safely beneath them. An instant later the blind man started up with a low cry of alarm.
"I hear steps coming," said he. "They are far off, but they draw nearer."
Simon thrust his head and neck down the hole.
"Squire Nigel," he whispered, "can you hear me?"
"I can hear you, Simon. Andreas says that someone comes." "Then cover the hole," came the answer. "Quick, I pray you, cover it over." A mantle was stretched across it, so that no glimmer of light should warn the newcomer. The fear was that he might have heard the sound of Nigel's descent, but soon it was clear that he had not done so, for Andreas announced that he was still advancing. Presently Nigel could hear the distant thud of his feet. If he bore a lantern, all was lost, but no gleam of light appeared in the black tunnel, and still the footsteps drew nearer. Nigel breathed a prayer of thanks to all his guardian saints as he crouched close to the slimy wall and waited breathless, his dagger in his hand. Nearer yet and nearer came the steps. He could hear the stranger's coarse breathing in the darkness. Then, as he brushed past, Nigel bounded upon him with a tiger spring. There was one gasp of astonishment, and not a sound more, for the squire's grip was on the man's throat, and his body was pinned motionless against the wall.
"Simon! Simon!" cried Nigel loudly.
The mantle was moved from the hole.
"Have you a cord, or your belts linked together may serve?"
One of the peasants had a rope, and Nigel soon felt it dangling against his hand. He listened, and there was no sound in the passage. For an instant he released the captive's throat. A torrent of prayers and entreaties came forth. The man was shaking like a leaf in the wind. Nigel pressed the point of his dagger against his face, and dared him to open his lips. Then he slipped the rope beneath his arms and tied it. "Pull him up," he whispered, and for an instant the grey glimmer above him was obscured.
"We have him, fair sir," said Simon.
"Then drop me the rope and hold it fast." A moment later Nigel stood among the group of men who had gathered round their captive. It was too dark to see him, and they dare not strike flint and steel. Simon passed his hand roughly over him, and felt a fat, clean-shaven face, and a cloth gabardine which hung to his ankles.
"Who are you?" he whispered. "Speak the truth, and speak it low, if you would ever speak again."
The man's teeth chattered in his head with cold and fright.
"I speak no English," he murmured.
"French, then," said Nigel.
"I am a holy priest of God. You caught the ban of Holy Church when you lay hands upon me. I pray you to let me go upon my way, for there are those whom I would shrive and housel. If they should die in sin, their damnation is upon you."
"How are you called, then?"
"I am Dom Peter de Serval."
"De Serval, the archpriest who heated the brazier when they burnt out my eyes!" cried old Andreas.
Of all the devils in hell, there is none fouler than this one. Friends, friends, if I have done aught for you this night, I ask but one reward, that you let me have my will of this man."
But Nigel pushed the old man back. "There is no time for this," he said. "Now, hark you, priest, if priest indeed you be, your gown and tonsure will not save you if you play us false, for we are here of a set purpose, and we will go forward with it, come what may. Answer me, and answer me truly, or it will be an ill night for you. In what part of the castle does this tunnel enter?"
"In the lower cellar."
"What is at the end?"
"An oaken door."
"Is it barred?"
"Yes, it is barred."
"How would you have entered?"
"I would have given the password."
"Who then would have opened?"
"There is a guard within."
"And beyond him?"
"Beyond him are the prison cells and the jailers."
"Who else would be afoot?"
"None save a guard at the gate and another on the battlement."
"What then is the password?"
The man was silent.
"The password, fellow!" The cold points of two daggers pricked his throat, but still he would not speak. "Where is the blind man?" asked Nigel. "Here, Andreas, you can have him and do what you will with him."
"Nay, nay," the priest whimpered. "Keep him off me. Save me from blind Andreas. I will tell you everything."
"The password, then, this instant."
"It is Benedicite."
"We have the password, Simon," cried Nigel. "Come then, let us on to the farther end. These peasants will guard the priest, and they will remain here lest we wish to send a message."
"Nay, fair sir, it is in my mind that we can do better," said Simon. "Let us take the priest with us, so that he who is within may know his voice."
"It is well thought of," said Nigel.
"And first let us pray together, for indeed this night may well be our last." He and the three men-at-arms knelt in the rain and sent up their simple orisons, Simon still clutching tight to the prisoner's wrist. The priest fumbled in his breast and drew something forth.
"It is the heart of the blessed confessor, St. Enogar," said he. "It may be that it will ease and assoil your souls, if you would wish to handle it."
The four Englishmen passed the flat silver case from hand to hand, each pressing his lips devoutly upon it. Then they rose to their feet. Nigel was the first to lower himself down the hole, then Simon, then the priest, who was instantly seized by the other two. The men-at-arms followed them. They had scarcely moved away from the hole when Nigel stopped.
"Surely someone else came after us," said he.
They listened, but no whisper or rustle came from behind them. For a minute they paused, and then resumed their journey through the dark. It seemed a long, long way, though in truth it was but a few hundred yards before they came to a door with a glimmer of yellow light around it, which barred their passage. Nigel struck upon it with his hand. There was the rasping of a bolt, and then a loud voice.
"Is that you, priest?"
"Yes, it is I," said the prisoner in a quavering voice. "Open, Arnold."
The voice was enough. There was no question of passwords. The door swung inward, and in an instant the janitor was cut down by Nigel and Simon. So sudden and so fierce was the attack, that save for the thud of his body, no sound was heard. A flood of light burst outward into the passage, and the Englishman stood with blinking eyes in its glare. In front of them lay a stone-flagged corridor, across which lay the dead body of the janitor. It had doors on either side of it, and another grated door at the farther end. A strange hubbub, a kind of low droning and whining, filled the air. Four men were standing listening, full of wonder as to what this might mean, when a sharp cry came from behind them. The priest lay in a shapeless heap upon the ground, and the blood was rushing from his gaping throat. Down the passage, a black shadow in the yellow light, there fled a crouching man who clattered with a stick as he went.
"It is Andreas," cried West Country Will. "He has slain him."
"Then it is he that I heard behind us," said Nigel. "Doubtless he was at our very heels in the darkness." "I fear that the priest's cry has been heard."
"Nay," said Simon, "there are so many cries that one more may well pass. Let us take this lamp from the wall and see what sort of devil's den we have around us."
They opened the door upon the right, and so horrible a smell issued from it that they were driven back from it. The lamp which Simon held forward showed a monkey-like creature mowing and grimacing in the corner. Man or woman, none could tell, but driven crazy by loneliness and horror. In the other cell was a grey-bearded man, fettered to the wall, looking blankly before him, a body without a soul, yet with life still in him, for his dull eyes turned slowly in their direction.
but it was from behind the central door at the end of the passage that the chorus of sad cries came which filled the air.
"Simon," said Nigel, "before we go further, we will take this outer door from its hinges. With it we will block this passage, so that at the worst we may hold our ground here until help comes. Do you back to the camp as fast as your feet can bear you. The peasants will draw you upward through the hole. Give my greetings to Sir Robert, and tell him that the castle is taken without fail if he comes this way with 50 men. Say that we have made a lodgment within the walls, and also tell him, Simon, that I would counsel him to make a stir before the gateway, so that the guard may be held there whilst we make good our footing behind them. Go, good Simon, and lose not a moment." But the man-at-arms shook his head. "It is I who have brought you here, fair sir, and here I abide through fair and foul. But you speak wisely and well, for Sir Robert should indeed be told what is going forward, now that we have gone so far. Harding, do you go with all speed, and bear the gentle Nigel's message." Reluctantly the man-at-arms sped upon his errand. They could hear the racing of his feet and the low jingle of his harness until they died away in the tunnel. Then the three companions approached the door at the end. It was their intention to wait where they were until help should come. But suddenly, amid the babble of cries within, there broke forth an English voice, shouting in torment.
"My God," it cried, "I pray you, comrades, for a cup of water, as you hope for Christ's mercy."
A shout of laughter and the thud of a heavy blow followed the appeal. All the hot blood rushed to Nigel's head at the sound, buzzing in his ears and throbbing in his temples. There are times when the fiery heart of a man must overbear the cold brain of a soldier. With one bound he was at the door, with another he was through it, the men-at-arms at his heels. So strange was the scene before them that for an instant all three stood motionless with horror and surprise. It was a great vaulted chamber, brightly lit by many torches. At the farther end roared a great fire. In front of it three naked men were chained to posts in such a way that, flinch as they might, they could never get beyond the range of its scorching heat. Yet they were so far from it that no actual burn could be inflicted if they could but keep turning and shifting so as continually to present some fresh portion of their flesh to the flames. Hence they danced and whirled in front of the fire, tossing ceaselessly this way and that within the compass of their chains, wearied to death, their protruding tongues cracked and blackened with thirst, but unable for one instant to rest from their writhings and contortions. Even stranger was the sight at each side of the room, whence came that chorus of groans which had first struck upon the ears of Nigel and his companions. A line of great hogsheads were placed alongside the walls, and within each sat a man, his head protruding from the top. As they moved within, there was a constant splashing and washing of water. The white, wan faces all turned together as the door flew open, and a cry of amazement and of hope took the place of those long-drawn moans of despair. At the same instant, two fellows clad in black, who had been seated with a flagon of wine between them at a table near the fire, sprang wildly to their feet, staring with blank amazement at this sudden inrush. That instant of delay deprived them of their last chance of safety. Midway down the room was a flight of stone steps which led to the main door. Swift as a wildcat, Nigel bounded towards it, and gained the steps a stride or two before the jailers. They turned and made for the other, which led to the passage, but Simon and his comrades were nearer to it than they. Two sweeping blows, two dagger thrusts into writhing figures, and the ruffians who worked the will of the butcher lay dead upon the floor of their slaughterhouse. Oh, the buzz of joy and of prayer from all those white lips! Oh, the light of returning hope in all those sunken, weary eyes! One wild shout would have gone up had not Nigel's outstretched hands and warning voice hushed them to silence. He opened the door behind him. A curving newel staircase wound upward into the darkness. He listened, but no sound came down. There was a key in the outer lock of the iron door. He whipped it out and turned it on the inner side. The ground that they had gained was safe. Now they could turn to the relief of those poor fellows beside them. A few strong blows struck off the irons and freed the three dancers before the fire. With a husky croak of joy, they rushed across to their comrades' water barrels, plunged their heads in like horses, and drank and drank and drank. Then, in turn, the poor shivering wretches were taken out of the barrels, their skins bleached and wrinkled with long soaking. Their bonds were torn from them, but cramped and fixed, their limbs refused to act, and they tumbled and twisted upon the floor in their efforts to reach Nigel and to kiss his hand. In a corner lay Aylward, dripping from his barrel and exhausted with cold and hunger. Nigel ran to his side and raised his head. The jug of wine from which the two jailers had drunk still stood upon their table. The squire placed it to the archer's lips, and he took a hearty pull at it. "How is it with you now, Aylward?"
"Better, squire, better, but may I never touch water again as long as I live. Alas, poor Deacon has gone, and Stephen also, the life chilled out of them. The cold is in the very marrow of my bones. I pray you, let me lean upon your arm as far as the fire, that I may warm the frozen blood and set it running in my veins once more."
A strange sight it was to see these 20 naked men crouching in a half circle round the fire, with their trembling hands extended to the blaze. Soon their tongues at least were thawed, and they poured out the story of their troubles with many a prayer and ejaculation to the saints for their safe delivery. No food had crossed their lips since they had been taken. The butcher had commanded them to join his garrison and to shoot upon their comrades from the wall. When they refused, he had set aside three of them for execution. The others had been dragged to the cellar, whither the leering tyrant had followed them. Only one question he had asked them, whether they were of a hot-blooded nature or of a cold. Blows were showered upon them until they answered. Three had said cold, and had been condemned to the torment of the fire. The rest, who had said hot, were delivered up to the torture of the water cask. Every few hours this man, or fiend, had come down to exult over their sufferings, and to ask them whether they were ready yet to enter his service. Three had consented and were gone. But the others had all of them stood firm, two of them even to their death. Such was the tale to which Nigel and his comrades listened, whilst they waited impatiently for the coming of Knolles and his men. Many an anxious look did they cast down the black tunnel, but no glimmer of light and no clash of steel came from its depths. Suddenly, however, a loud and measured sound broke upon their ears. It was a dull metallic clang, ponderous and slow, growing louder and ever louder, the tread of an armored man. The poor wretches round the fire, all unnerved by hunger and suffering, huddled together with wan, scared faces, their eyes fixed in terror on the door. "It is he," they whispered. "It is the butcher himself." Nigel had darted to the door and listened intently. There were no footfalls save those of one man. Once sure of that, he softly turned the key in the lock. At the same instant there came a bull's bellow from without. "Eve! Bertrand!" cried the voice. "Can you not hear me coming, you drunken varlets? You shall cool your own heads in the water casks, you lazy rascals. What? Not even now? Open, you dogs, open, I say." He had thrust down the latch, and with a kick he flung the door wide and rushed inward. For an instant he stood motionless, a statue of dull yellow metal, his eyes fixed upon the empty casks and the huddle of naked men. Then, with the roar of a trapped lion, he turned, but the door had slammed behind him, and Black Simon, with grim figure and sardonic face, stood between. The butcher looked round him helplessly, for he was unarmed save for his dagger. Then his eyes fell upon Nigel's roses. "You are a gentleman of coat armor," he cried. "I surrender myself to you." "I will not take your surrender, you black villain," said Nigel. "Draw and defend yourself. Simon, give him your sword."
"Nay, this is madness," said the blunt man-at-arms. "Why should I give the wasp a sting?"
"Give it to him, I say. I cannot kill him in cold blood."
"But I can," yelled Aylward,
who had come up from the fire.
"Comrades, comrades, by these 10 finger bones, has he not taught us how cold blood should be warmed?"
Like a pack of wolves they were on him, and he clanged upon the floor with a dozen frenzied, naked figures clutching and clinging above him. In vain Nigel tried to pull them off. They were mad with rage, these tortured, starving men, their eyes fixed and glaring, their hair on end, their teeth gnashing with fury, while they tore at the howling, writhing man. Then, with a rattle and clatter, they pulled him across the room by his two ankles and dragged him into the fire. Nigel shuddered and turned away his eyes as he saw the brazen figure roll out and stagger to his knees, only to be hurled once more into the heart of the blaze. His prisoners screamed with joy and clapped their hands as they pushed him back with their feet until the armor was too hot for them to touch. Then, at last, he lay still, and glowed darkly red, whilst the naked men danced in a wild half-circle round the fire. But now, at last, the supports had come. lights flashed and armor gleamed down the tunnel. The cellar filled with armed men, while from above came the cries and turmoil of the feigned assault upon the gate. Led by Knolles and Nigel, the storming party rushed upward and seized the courtyard. The guard of the gate, taken in the rear, threw down their weapons and cried for mercy. The gate was thrown open, and the assailants rushed in, with hundreds of furious peasants at their heels. Some of the robbers died in hot blood, many in cold, but all died, for Knolles had vowed to give no quarter. Day was just breaking when the last fugitive had been hunted out and slain. From all sides came the yells and whoops of the soldiers, with the rending and riving of doors as they burst into the storerooms and treasure chambers. There was a joyous scramble amongst them, for the plunder of 11 years, gold and jewels, satins and velvets, rich plate and noble hangings, were all to be had for the taking. The rescued prisoners, their hunger appeased and their clothes restored, led the search for booty. Nigel, leaning on his sword by the gateway, saw Aylward totter past, a huge bundle under each arm, another slung over his back, and a smaller packet hanging from his mouth. He dropped it for a moment as he passed his young master.
"By these 10 finger bones, I am right glad that I came to the war, and no man could ask for a more goodly life," said he. "I have a present here for every girl in Tilford, and my father need never fear the frown of the sacrist of Waverley again. But how of you, Squire Loring? It standeth not aright that we should gather the harvest, whilst you, who sowed it, go forth empty-handed. Come, gentle sir, take these things I have gathered, and I will go back and find more."
But Nigel smiled and shook his head. "You have gained what your heart desired, and perchance I have done so also," said he. An instant later Knolles strode up to him with outstretched hand. "I ask your pardon, Nigel," said he. "I have spoken too hotly in my wrath." "Nay, fair sir, I was at fault. If we stand here now within the castle, it is to you that I owe it. The king shall know of it, and Chandos also. Can I do aught else, Nigel, to prove to you the high esteem in which I hold you?" The squire flushed with pleasure. "Do you send a messenger home to England, fair sir, with news of these doings?" "Surely I must do, but do not tell me, Nigel, that you would be that messenger. Ask some other favor, for indeed I cannot let you go." "Now, God forbid!" cried Nigel. "By St. Paul, I would not be so caitiff and so thrall as to leave you when some small deed might still be done. But I would fain send a message by your messenger." "To whom?" "It is to the Lady Mary, daughter of old Sir John Butsthorn, who dwells near Guildford." "But you will write the message, Nigel. Such greetings as a cavalier sends to his lady love should be under seal."
"Nay, he can carry my message by word of mouth."
"Then I shall tell him, for he goes this morning. What message, then, shall he say to the lady?"
"He will give her my very humble greeting, and he will say to her that for the second time St. Catherine has been our friend." End of chapter 21.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.